The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Here at Oracle, I have learned the darkness of Tuellafar hearts and the cruelty of Tuellafar generosity, for they do nothing for the good of a human. They use that guise merely to gain full control, that they might manipulate their rangers to serve only the Tuellafar. But here at Oracle, I learn to turn their duplicitous games back upon them. How delicious will the irony be when I crush them?
He possesses me. Adrian, our king. I am not strong enough to begin to deny him. There is no resistance within me. He is strong, Roger. So terribly strong.
They're all dead now, you know. Avalyn. Jojona. Oh, yes. I had the distinct pleasure of heaping the logs onto the pyre that burned that heretic. And Elbrian, by my own hand. Oh, and Brahmin Herd, you know, by my own hand.
You lie.
The river has taken him out into the gulf by now, of course. The fish have no doubt nibbled the flesh from his bones.
You lie!
Too long have I waited for this moment, Dasselrond. It was your grave error in training me. You made me too strong.
My greatest error was in not allowing you to die on the field outside of Palmares. For I erred in my estimation of your parentage. I thought Elbrian to be your father, but in truth it was Bestus Belzebar.
Because I reject you and your wretched kin. Because I have become too great to be controlled by the Tuellafar. You fear me and taunt me because you know that you cannot defeat me.
I already have.
Choice. A curious word. And our two kingdoms stand on a steep precipice. One whose outcome will be decided by the choices of their leaders. A precipice as sharp as the plateau divide that separates Beren and Togai. And do note, Dragon of Togai, upon which side of that dividing line Darian resides. Choose wisely.
I already have.
Meet my dragon, Yator de Haman.
The girl thinks of everything. But I've trained that one well, I have.
Don't miss part 2 of the final tale in the Demon War Saga, Book 7, Immortalis. Available now in Graphic Audio.
He's done the old man proud. By leaping into the path of danger, Matt Jensen foiled a train robbery in Colorado.
We just killed the engineer. You done open that door in 5 seconds, I'll kill the fireman too.
Hold it, son of a bitch, Greyhorn. It's Jensen. Jensen's on the train.
Get the horses. Let's get out of here.
Now the governor himself has presented Matt with a public reward. But what started on the rails has now moved onto the bloody streets of the world and has taken on a life of its own.
That Jensen fella is one son of a bitch we need to avoid.
Or kill.
I'm here, Hennessy.
Well, we meet again. Only this time you don't have the drop on me. We meet even.
Not entirely even.
Now a frustrated outlaw and his murderous posse have struck again. This time, kidnapping the governor's niece.
If you scream, I'll pull the trigger. That's a good girl. Now get up.
What now?
It all depends.
It depends on what?
Whether or not the governor pays what we're gonna ask him.
Now Matt Jensen, the last mountain man, is riding hard towards an inevitable destiny. One filled with blood and death. That's where Matt will learn how to put a bad man down. And make sure he stays that way.
Damn, you're good. I thought I could beat you. I really thought.
Looks like I'm gonna need a refill, Paul. Shooting people always makes me thirsty.
Don't miss Matt Jensen's Body Count Rise in Matt Jensen, The Last Mountain Man number 2, Deadly Train, in Graphic Audio.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Jerry Ahern's The Survivalist. Narrated by Terrence Aselford. With performances by Eric Messner, Nanette Savard, Michael Glenn, Ken Jackson, MJ Casey, Dylan Lynch, Laura Quinn Anderson, Yasmin Toison, Tony Nam, MB Van Dorn, Ren Casey, David Coyne, Scott McCormick, James Konacek, Elizabeth Jernigan, and Mort Shelby. Survivalist number 23, Call to Battle. John Rourke stared down at his son, Michael. Rourke's right hand held Michael's right hand.
You'll be okay, son. You did well.
Thanks, Dad.
John Rourke glanced at the two stretcher bearers, signaled them to move out. They continued on their way, Michael between them, carrying him toward the medevac helicopter. The helicopter, one of several on the ground here, waited just beyond the patio, in the grassy yard between the house and still-burning garage, its rotor blades swishing lazily through the warm air. The garage was very near the stables, but the stables were unoccupied, used only for storage. So far, crates of weapons and containers of explosives were all that had been found within the structure. A fire truck was parked between the stables and the garage. Its crew worked to extinguish the garage fire, but more importantly, strove to prevent the fire's spreading to the stables and touching off the saboteur's explosives. The plastique itself would not detonate, of course, from flame alone. But other items stored within the stables might explode, and then in turn cause the plastique to blow. Natalia sat on one of the patio chairs. A medic was kneeling beside her, tending to the deep graze wound across her upper arm, just below the joint. Rourke himself had cursorily examined the injury, satisfying himself that it was minor. When her wound was patched, she would follow Michael to the hospital at Pearl Harbor, Rourke knew. He would have preferred to see her stay behind to assist in the preliminary evaluation of the captured intelligence data. Without her noticing him, Rourke studied her face. Despite looking battle-worn and tired, it was always beautiful. Michael was a lucky man to have her. The two men and one woman whom Rourke had captured in the structure's basement, he'd shot a fourth person, were seated on the far side of the patio. They had been about to burn the computer printouts and degauss magnetic computer disks, thus destroying the information whose capture was the very purpose of this raid. The three were surrounded by several of the SEAL team personnel under Lieutenant Commander Washington. Other prisoners, including the man who surrendered to Rourke, were marshaled together near two of the Honolulu TAC team vans. These vans, Rourke had been told, would be loaned to the Navy in order to transport the captured personnel to Pearl for interrogation. Paul and Annie, neither of them injured during the assault against the estate, disappeared into the basement record center moments after Rourke emerged from it in the wake of securing the house. And now, John Rourke had absolutely nothing which required immediate doing. The cigar he lit in the basement was long since burned down and discarded. The magazines for his rifle were reloaded, as were the magazines for his pistols. The men and women about him, personnel from the Honolulu TAC team and Washington's SEAL team, seemed flush with victory, and each moved about as though he or she was on the most important mission imaginable. Indeed, the battle was done. But their rest would be brief. The war with Eden still remained to be won or lost. Perhaps what was gained here would retard that war's start, an attack on the Hawaiian Islands, centering on the new Pearl Harbor Naval Base. The attack's intent much the same as a similar attack made on December 7th of 1941 by the Japanese. Crippled the U.S. fleet. But the attackers this time would not be flying Japanese Zeros. The attackers would be SS personnel, exiled from New Germany and Argentina, spearheading the forces of Eden, with a host of technologically advanced weapons at their disposal. Eden was the new nation occupying the eastern half of what, before the night of the war, had been the United States of America. The United States of America, these days, more than 6 centuries after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor and a post-war period which led inexorably to thermonuclear destruction, consisted of 2 states only. One of these states was composed of the Hawaiian Islands. The second was Midwake. Midwake was a domed community beneath the Pacific Ocean, almost equidistant between the islands of Midway and Wake, hence the name. Hawaii, like virtually everything on the Earth's surface, was swept clean of things man-made, scoured during the Great Conflagration, when the ionized atmosphere caught fire at dawn and burned away cities and governments and the men who had made them. Midwake, a scientific base originally designed for undersea research and involved in experimental studies concerning the planned building of a permanent United States space station, was not destroyed. The ancestors of the current residents of Eden survived as well, but by totally different means, making what transpired at Midwake seem almost ordinary by comparison. The core of Eden's population grew from the survivors of a group of 132 persons who, preserved in cryogenic sleep, were launched into space on the very night of the war. The shuttle fleet which carried them was a lifeboat for humanity, an ark to return and begin civilization anew when the storm of warfare and its even more destructive aftermath abated. Unfortunately, the Eden Project returnees brought back with them many of the same ills which had precipitated mankind's near-total destruction before. Principal among these faults were the lust for power at any price and the willingness to hate. These negative qualities were shared among only a few of the returning personnel, but as in the old adage about the rotten apple, so it was with Eden. Today, Eden was controlled by a puppet dictator, a Nazi. Eden's war machine was the most powerful and potentially deadly on Earth. Nuclear weapons were once again being built at a frantic pace. Chemical and biological weapons were rumored to exist in Eden's vast arsenals as well. 6 persons on the face of the Earth survived from the days before the night of the war. John Rourke's son and daughter, Michael and Annie, the man who became Annie's husband, Paul Rubinstein, Natalia Tyamarovna, Rourke himself, and his wife, Sarah. But Sarah was in cryogenic sleep, the only means of keeping her alive. On the night that their third child, a boy, was born, Sarah was shot, the bullet entering her brain, lodging in so sensitive and remote an area that the projectile was accessible perhaps to only one man. That man was Dr. Dietrich Zimmer, the same man who shot her, the same man who kidnapped the infant to whom Sarah had just given birth. That child was, these days, known as Martin Zimmer, the Nazi dictator of Eden. Because of sophisticated genetic surgery and the lies of Dietrich Zimmer, Martin, although he was all but physically identical to John Rourke and Michael Rourke, was no longer a Rourke, no longer the child Sarah had nurtured in her body for 9 months. Dietrich Zimmer twisted the boy, made him into someone to whom good and evil were not moral considerations, only useless abstractions for the weak. Then, both Dietrich Zimmer and the boy utilized cryogenic sleep until the time was right to awaken to conquest. But before they slept, Dietrich Zimmer ordered his neo-Nazi followers to strike the supposed repository of the cryogenic chambers in which John Rourke and his family slept. Those cryogenic chambers, held at Midwake, were destroyed. In Dietrich Zimmer's supposition of victory, there was safety for Rourke and his family. The night Martin was born and Sarah was shot, John Rourke himself was critically injured, slipping more deeply into coma by the hour. The one hope of saving him and preserving Sarah, her condition was inoperable, was a gamble, a slim chance that the coincidentally restorative benefits of cryogenic sleep might somehow keep her alive and sustain his life so that his body might naturally be able to rise above the comatose state. Unbeknownst to him then, of course, his son, his daughter's husband, and his best friend, Paul, and Natalia all volunteered to take the sleep in order that the family might be preserved somehow, some way in the future, whenever that would be. And this was now, 125 years after the night Sarah was shot, a world once again on the brink of self-destruction. John Rourke was one of six human beings to survive the night of the war and live into this present age. One of only six human beings who remembered what once was and its destruction. And John Rourke had promised himself that while he lived, he would fight to keep the destruction and the death from recurring.
John?
How you feeling?
I've been better, but I've been a great deal worse too. I want to go to the hospital just in case.
And Michael needs you.
Yes.
We'll be fine here. Make sure your arm gets looked at too. It won't hurt.
No. It's starting again, isn't it? Everything like before. Are people crazy?
We won't let them be crazy this time.
Natalia gave him a brief smile, then started across the patio, toward the grassy area beyond and the choppers waiting there. Rourke followed her with his eyes. He still loved her, and she loved him, he realized. The only thing that was changed was that she realized she loved Michael more. What he, John Rourke, had always wanted for her and for Michael. But now that it had happened, he felt the loneliness of his life more acutely than he had ever experienced. If, once Sarah had the operation she needed, which still only Dietrich Zimmer could perform, all would not be happiness. Because Rourke would have to stop Martin Zimmer and Dietrich Zimmer from taking the world beyond the brink once again. And that would most likely mean killing Martin, their son, Sarah's child. Years ago, in order to ensure survival, he had tampered with the cryogenic chambers, allowed the children, Michael and Annie, to grow to adulthood while he and Sarah and Paul and Natalia slept on. And in the process, he denied Sarah her children, seeing them grow up. When Sarah awoke, she all but cursed him for what he had done, depriving her so. And now, once she was restored, he would do worse, kill the child for whom she had nearly died when she brought him into the world. Sarah would never forgive him. John Rourke was used to loneliness, self-inflicted, and it would not end, perhaps it would never end, for him. And however inured he was to loneliness, he didn't like it.
John!
Yes, Paul?
We got problems, John. Annie and I have been going through the printouts that were all piled up there in the middle of the basement for them to burn. There's a reference to an SS commando unit. It's coming ashore on Molokai in less than half an hour if they're on schedule. They couldn't have been alerted to what was going on here, so they should still be coming.
Any indication this is the first prong of the invasion?
Nah. From what we could pick up, it looks like they're coming here to soften up things. Terrorism.
All right, get Ed Shaw and Lieutenant Commander Washington. Tell them. Have them get some people together. I'll arrange transportation.
It was starting again. Aboard the helicopter gunship, John Rourke changed to what he considered more suitable and less flashy clothing. He removed the garish Aloha shirt he'd worn when he disguised himself as a German tourist in order to get one of the estate guards down to the front gates. Less than 2 hours ago, all that seemed an eternity away. His hair was still dyed blonde to go along with the disguise, but the dye would shampoo out. Yet there was no time to do that. He changed into black jeans, a long-sleeved black knit shirt, he pushed the sleeves up almost to the elbows, then started to pull on his boots. Paul was reloading magazines for his German MP-40 submachine gun. The others aboard the helicopter, 30 men in all, from the Honolulu TAC team and Washington's SEAL team, based out of Pearl Harbor, saw to their weapons as well. Like SEAL teams from the 20th century, these SEALs seem to have rather eclectic tastes in weaponry. The issue military pistol these days was an energy weapon, but these men didn't carry the issue weapon. Instead, their sidearms were cartridge arms, and he found the particular type most curious. During the latter portion of the 20th century, considerable controversy raged between those who were aficionados of the Colt Browning style 45 ACP and everyone else. John Rourke had periodically found himself on both sides of the issue, and occasionally in the middle. His own personal sidearms of preference were Colt Browning style 45s, reduced drastically in size and manufactured by the original Detonix firm. Yet he often carried a revolver as well, and sometimes the 9mm Parabellum cartridge suited a particular tactical need and he used it. Cartridge arms of the 19th and 20th centuries were only from two sources these days: original pieces of enormous collector value, like the guns Rourke himself wore, and reproductions made by Lancer. John Thomas Rourke assumed none of the SEALs carried original antiques, but to a man, they carried Colt Browning-style 45 ACPs. What made him smile was the thought that if somehow those staunchest of the staunch supporters of old slab sides could have known that nearly seven centuries after the first 45 rolled off the line as the original 1911, the same basic gun was the choice of an elite unit such as this, they would have smiled too. There were knives of every description, most of these based on familiar designs as well. Bowies, Tontos, big ugly ones, double-edged commando daggers of the Fairbairn Sykes, or stouter Randall patterns.
We're approaching the LZ touchdown at 5.
John Rourke slung the double Alessi rig, which carried the twin stainless Titanics combat masters, across his shoulders, then looked to the rest of his weapons. They'd exited the chopper in admirable time. TAC team and SEAL team personnel, they trained together, often functioning smoothly as a single unit, setting up perimeter security the instant after the chopper was on the ground, maintaining that security as Rourke, Rubenstein, and the others, Ed Shaw and Lieutenant Commander Washington among them, reached the tree line, then covered the security element's withdrawal. The grass here was high, untrammeled, whipping wildly back and forth in the cool downdraft of the rotor blades, the palm fronds moving as well. Once they linked up, they split again, but into two operational teams. Rourke and Rubenstein staying with Shaw and his TAC team personnel, moving northwesterly toward the beach, which was more than a mile distant. Over the intervening centuries since John Rourke had first visited Hawaii, the coastlines of the islands had changed radically on account of natural volcanic growth and on account of the generally lowered sea levels, a result of glaciation in the northern hemisphere, which had significantly increased the collective Hawaiian landmass. Now there were high-ranging cliffs, more like the English coast near Dover than anything John Rourke had seen here centuries ago. They stopped to rest and reconnoiter at the height of these cliffs, where the coastline lay more than 100 feet below them, rugged in the extreme, with black rocks like a fortress wall against the attacking breakers, the waves advancing, retreating, assaulting the land again. This was not the sort of coastline John Rourke would have chosen for a clandestine landing. The potential for arriving unseen was significant, but even more significant was the potential for arriving dead unless every man jack of the SS Commando unit was a superb swimmer and reckless in the extreme. Rourke said as much to Paul Rubenstein and Ed Shaw.
They couldn't have picked a more remote spot. No one comes here. The occasional fishing vessel or pleasure craft might lie well off the coast, but they won't have the risk of bumping into military personnel, civilians, anyone. We've trained on cliffs like these, but the surf down there is too wild to risk a man's life in a training exercise.
John Rourke looked at his watch. Washington's team should be in position, and in 10 minutes it would be within the window for the arrival of the commando unit.
We better move out.
Agreed.
There were niches within the cliff faces. Perhaps once volcanic pipes, now the haunts of the occasional seabird. Wildlife was returning, in some cases in significant numbers, or merely empty holes in the bleached rock. In one such hole, John Rourke, Paul Rubenstein, Shaw, and two of the TAC team men stopped, the other 10 men moving on to find similar positions here midway along the cliff faces over the rock-strewn beach below. Shaw and the other two TAC team men began unlimbering their powered hang gliders.
Why do you guys use those things? They're like a kite with a lawnmower motor.
A lot of terrain was given a beating since the night of the war, and in some places, a lot of places in these islands, the terrain was pretty rugged to begin with. Electronic sensing gear is so high-tech these days, if we had a helicopter waiting to come in anywhere within a mile or more, the bad guys would know it. This way we can move in fast, silently, and we have such a low sensing profile we don't usually get spotted. Once the bad guys are on the beach, we can get down there in seconds.
They can shoot at you.
Hard to hit a fast-moving aerial target. Anyway, we can shoot back. You want to fly one?
Only if I have to, Ed.
Nearly an hour passed. Rourke's head was starting to ache slightly from the eye strain caused by constantly peering out over the ocean, both with unaided eyes and through the borrowed pair of German field glasses he was using. Nothing relieved the sea's surface except the occasional bird. There were periodic low-frequency radio checks with Lieutenant Commander Washington's SEAL team personnel. The same story came from their observation post. Nothing. To relieve the monotony, Rourke took one of the spare bootlaces from his musette bag and showed the TAC team personnel how to make one of the old OSS string holsters, a trick he learned years ago before the night of the war from one of his best friends. This demonstrated, they returned to the boredom of waiting. An hour and a half was gone, still nothing in sight on the ocean surface. A squall line was forming to the north, blue-black thunderheads rolling in rather quickly, low over the water.
Well, maybe we got it wrong, or somehow the SS found out we hit the estate and canceled the insertion, or maybe...
Think again, Ed!
Paul was looking through the electronic imaging telescopic sight of the counter-sniper rifle one of the TAC team personnel carried.
Try about 2 o'clock in the surface, maybe 200 yards out.
John Rourke dropped into a prone position beside Paul, his elbows set on the rock. At first, Rourke saw nothing, so he put the glasses down, focused his eyes on the approximate spot, then raised the glasses and tried again. This time, he saw something on the surface of the water, only an irregularity, unidentifiable, but somehow out of place.
It's a snorkel. Someone near the surface, maybe recon on the beach.
Glasses down, everybody. Pull back. Ed, tell Washington, and tell him to have his men do the same.
All right, we got him.
Dark shapes moved near the surface of the water, breaking the foam-flecked crests of the waves with their bodies. Rourke's eyes squinted against the light as he watched them over his iron-sighted rifle.
Be patient.
The storm clouds were rolling in more rapidly now. Rourke gave the weather system between 5 and 10 minutes before it crashed over the beach. The radio frequency shared by the TAC team and Washington SEAL team was continually open now, because if the SS commando unit moving out of the water and onto the beach had not picked up a transmission by now, they wouldn't pick it up at all. The danger, of course, had been that they scanned. Rourke would have done so, moving such a large body of men. These SS personnel apparently had not. A tactical error, and everyone made one from time to time. Only occasionally were they critical. Similarly, Rourke would not have brought such a group in without cover of darkness, even in so remote and little frequented a spot as this. But this latter would not be a tactical error, rather circumstances imposed by the inescapable exigency of some rendezvous that could not be set for a more advantageous time.
What the hell do we do now? It's more than we thought, huh?
Their numbers, the TAC team and SEAL teams combined, amounted to a rough half of those of the enemy. John Rourke glanced at Paul Rubinstein and saw the worried look in his friend's eyes.
Get the rest of your people and Washington's people ready to move out. All the men with these powered hang gliders, how safe are they?
Pretty safe, if the operator does his part.
Control's pretty simple.
Yeah, it's just a joystick. Push it forward and you nose down. Pull back, yeah.
I get the idea. How about lateral orientation, side to side?
Yeah.
And speed?
25 miles per hour tops, but you gotta ride the thermals or you crash like a stone. You're not thinking of...
Yes, I am.
Fully 5 minutes had passed. Rourke strapped into the harness for the powered glider. John Rourke readied himself near the cave entrance, ready to soar like an eagle over the beach or fall flat on his face and die like a turkey with clipped wings.
Wow. This should be fun.
John Rourke jumped into the void beyond the ledge. As he glided toward it, he pushed his body upward with his hands and arms, securing his feet into the breakaway stirrups. In the next instant, he pulled the throttle two-thirds back, the bank of miniaturized ramjets which were set in the wedge-shaped wing above him firing. He banked slowly instead, coming to port and out over the beach.
We're moving in.
It was Washington's voice, and Rourke certainly hoped the SEAL team commander and his men were moving in. It could become very lonely very quickly for 4 men flying over this beach, set against fully 60 heavily armed enemy personnel. And he was confident that all of the commandos would be men. Nazis, as well as being racist, were generally by philosophy sexist as well.
Fire at will! Fire at will!
Rourke had traded weapons with Paul Rubinstein, swapping the long-range-capable HK-91 for the more maneuverable German MP-40 submachine gun and its faster cyclic rate. 3 other of the TAC team personnel soared over the beach. The men below them started to return fire before any enemy fire could come close to him or the 3 other men from the TAC team. Shooting accurately from the powered hang glider was, he discovered, even more difficult than shooting accurately from a moving horse. And that was next to impossible. But the horse analogy stood him in good stead as he suddenly realized what his tactics should be. He banked the powered hang glider in a gentle arc to starboard, less than 30 feet over the crests of the waves. Shaw's men and Paul Rubinstein were roping their way down the cliff face on power descenders, but the swarm of SS commandos on the beach were concentrating their fire toward the men in the powered hang gliders. Rourke and the 3 men with him made another pass. Rourke brought down 3 of the SS commandos as he throttled back and banked to starboard, just avoiding the rock face of the cliffs. He began another pass, the submachine gun nearly empty, again waiting until he was close. From his right, coming in low over the sand, John Rourke saw another group of men flying powered hang gliders. Six more, SEAL team personnel, Lieutenant Commander Washington leading them. The SEALs, despite their demonstrated preference for cartridge arms as handguns, were carrying submachine gun-sized energy weapons of a type Rourke had never seen before in action. To his left, Rourke saw Ed Shaw himself take a series of energy bursts to the hang glider wings. The wings catching fire, their ramjets immediately flaming out. Shaw spiraled downward toward the sand.
Oh, too close to the sun, boys. I'm ahead. I'm going down. Shit.
In the next instant, as Ed Shaw lay sprawled there, stunned, unconscious, or dead, a half dozen of the SS men swarmed over him. Firing into them, if Shaw were somehow still alive, would ensure the TAC team leader's death. Rourke banked the powered hang glider steeply to port, throttling back, then radically forward on the joystick, climbing, then descending, swooping over the beach, low. He was nearly over the six commandos who fell upon Ed Shaw, Rourke's left hand poised over the emergency release for the glider harness.
Like an avenging angel.
His body twisted, his arms reaching out. His body slammed into and over three of the men. Rourke was up to his feet, his right hand on the pistol grip of the submachine gun. Rourke wheeled toward the remaining three. Shaw was alive, his clothing partially consumed with flames, his hands on the arm of one of the commandos. John Rourke wheeled half left and with his right foot snapped a double taekwondo kick to the SS commando's face. Rourke moved toward Ed Shaw, but Shaw was to his feet, starting to run. Panicked, Rourke realized. John Rourke had seen other good and brave men lose it when their clothing was aflame, and Shaw had lost it. Rourke dodged past the two remaining SS commandos, throwing a body block against Ed Shaw. Rourke scooped up handfuls of sand, hurtling them over the still-burning portions of Shaw's clothing. It was a blur of movement, Rourke dodging right as the buttstock of an Eden assault rifle smashed downward, glancing off his left shoulder. Rourke turned half around, punching Paul's submachine gun forward. He stepped back, letting the submachine gun fall to his side on its sling as he drew both full-sized Scoremasters from his waistband, thumbing back the hammers.
Trigger control!
Touché!
Shaw was to his knees.
I'm all right! I'm all right!
Rourke took Ed Shaw at his word, then started forward, joining the TAC team and SEAL team personnel who battled the SS commandos here on the beach amid the foaming surf. Rourke's eyes squinted against the light, but rolling in fast over the water were the dark thunderheads. As Rourke advanced along the beach, he saw a Nazi that was about to finish the Navy man with a diving knife. Rourke turned to his left, firing point blank into the chest of another of the SS men. Rourke kept moving. Rain began, not falling, but driving in icy, wind-driven sheets which rolled savagely over the beach. Rourke was immediately drenched, his clothes plastered to his body. He saw two men running for cover. He dropped one of the men. The second man hurled a grenade.
Grenade!
Rourke looked up, wiping his left forearm across his face to clear his eyes. Rourke was to his feet, thumbing up the safeties on both Scoremasters, grabbing up a weapon from the sand, one of the German assault rifles. He stabbed it toward a knot of the SS men. Two men came at Rourke now from the rocks. Rourke spun toward them. Two of the powered hang gliders swept through the rain, skimmed the surf, their pilots firing into a group of 15 SS commandos trying to escape the beach. From the far left edge of Rourke's peripheral vision, he could see Paul rallying some of the TAC team men, cutting off the rest of the commando force. Rourke discarded the emptied Eden assault rifle, slicing the sling of another free from the dead man to whose body it was still attached. Clamping the rifle's buttstock against his side to steady it, Rourke advanced, closing in from the rear of the commandos who were in flight. There was nothing left but killing. In more than six centuries, John Rourke was inured to it, but he prayed he would never come to like it, no matter how long he lived. Emma Shaw, who had changed into a man-sized extra-large pink T-shirt, which came down to her knees, with nothing but her panties on underneath, sat cross-legged on the old-fashioned, overstuffed sectional sofa. These days, so much furniture was air-filled, but she'd grown up with furniture like this and liked it still. Her eyes were focused on the video panel set into the wall of her little house in the mountains. She was rarely off-duty enough these days to use the place, but she had a lot of leave time coming and decided to use a few days and get away to take advantage of what would probably be the short lull before a long war. She needed to think. Snow lay soft and white on the giant pear-shaped leaves of the magnolias outside her front windows, beyond the small porch. In the days before the night of the war, some actual cold weather training exercises were run in the Hawaiian Islands by the Marine Corps, but the weather was nothing like this. Of course, it was rarely cold enough in the islands for snow to stick to roadways. It did not now. But often cold enough in the higher elevations for the snow to form a beautiful icing on the magnolias, the pines, the palms, and the rest of the lush vegetation here. The pineapple growers always groused about it, but there was never a hard enough freeze to cause them more than some anxiety. On the other side of the island, everything grew better, of course, denser and greener because of the volcanism which, over the centuries, periodically renewed the soil. She had chosen this spot because, if she lived to be 100, which lots of people did these days, no volcano, unless a new one emerged, could touch her here. Emma Shaw's eyes drifted back to the early evening news broadcasts. It was footage from a remotely piloted Skyvid that she watched now, flying over the beach where only a comparatively short while before, John Rourke and her brother and a lot of other good people, some of them dead, had repelled an amphibious assault by troops.
Dr. Rourke, the almost legendary survivor from more than six centuries ago through the use of experimental cryogenic technology, holds the rank of Brigadier General in the United States Armed Forces from the period more than 100 years ago when Midwake, our progenitor state, fought against the forces of then-communist-dominated Russia. Due in large part to Dr. Rourke's heroic efforts, the United States and its allies defeated the Soviet Union as the culmination of the war which lasted for more than five centuries and all but wiped out human life on the surface of the planet. Channel 3's Jackie Warren caught up with Dr. Rourke as he exited a naval helicopter after the successful mission involving the Navy SEAL team personnel and the Honolulu TAC team.
Dr. Rourke, I'm Jackie Warren from Channel 3 Up Close News.
How nice for you.
Doctor, I understand that you spearheaded the counterattack against the commando force sent against the islands this afternoon, and...
The men of Commander Washington's SEAL team and Ed Shaw's Honolulu TAC team were a pleasure to watch. It's a rare treat to see such shining professionalism.
But I understand, Dr. Rourke, that you...
Yes, I was right there watching the whole thing. They were magnificent. You'll have to excuse me.
Emma Shaw flicked TV channels to MTV. She knew the real story because her brother Ed had called her to assure her that he wasn't seriously injured, thinking she might have heard that his glider was shot down and his flame-retardant suit had caught on fire.
That John Rourke and Rubenstein, too. Talk about two terrific guys to have on your side, Emma. Whoa, I was on fire. The synth fuel was all over me and burning, and the damn heat was getting at me through my suit, see? Dr. Rourke gets all these guys off me, then decks me with a tackle. Could have used him when we played football. And then puts the fire out. Then so help me, he takes out better than a dozen guys single-handedly. That's one tough guy, let me tell you. But I'm fine, sis.
When Emma Shaw closed her eyes, she could see John Rourke. She even dreamed about him when she slept. She stood up, got off the couch, and walked across the large single room, which was her great room. The A-frame, a combination of synth stone and synth wood prefab units, had a 14-foot vault at the height of the ceiling where the joists met. It looked like a mountain cabin should look. A real fireplace that could burn real wood, as well as synth logs, the whole nine yards. Barefoot, she walked up the three steps to the level of the little hall and turned left toward the kitchen. Her phone was resting on the counter and she picked it up, started walking back toward the couch, touching the numerals for the Pearl Harbor base locator. She got John's number and had herself connected.
Hello.
John, it's Emma Shaw.
Yes.
I'm sure you probably don't want to, but would you like to come up into the mountains to my place for dinner? I'm not half bad cooking.
Sure.
Holy shit!
You still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Are you sure it won't be too much trouble?
Nothing I like better than cooking. easy to find my place. Just, come up Highway 1 to the turnoff for Darkwood Way, okay? Follow Darkwood Way until you're up into the mountains, and, you'll see a sign for Theodore Roosevelt Drive. And then take that up north, and you'll see my box. My delivery box, I mean. Just come up on the drive. Shouldn't take you more than 30 minutes.
What time?
8:30? Oh, that's too late, isn't it?
No, that's fine.
Just dress comfortable, huh?
Sure. Should I Bring anything?
What do you like to drink?
Well, I used to be partial to Seagram 7.
John?
Yeah.
Oh, what is that?
A blended whiskey.
I've got plenty of that. See you then.
Looking forward to it.
Emma Shaw spun on the balls of her bare feet and looked toward the kitchen.
It's microwave time.
She went into action. John Rourke had just walked in from debriefing when Emma Shaw caught him on the telephone. As soon as she rang off, he called Commander Washington for a recommendation on getting a car. Washington said it would be all right to check out an FOUO electric car from Pearl's Motor Pool. Emma Shaw was a pretty girl, but more important than that, she was intelligent and gutsy. He enjoyed talking to her and could use some relaxation. After making his phone calls, he changed to a new Flint and the battered old Zippo wind lighter he always carried and refilled with synth fuel. These days, lighters were either the disposable kind, but synth-fueled, or more commonly, electric. He preferred what he was used to. The Germans were working on self-renewing metals, something about which he hadn't read sufficiently to understand fully. But if he had it right and could get them to make flints for him, he'd never have to change flints again. But that would be too perfect. Without work, what was life? He cleaned his guns, too, reasoning that after he got out of the shower, there would be no sense getting his hands all covered with lubricant. Emma Shaw implied she was a good cook. A home-cooked meal and some good conversation would be a treat.
Oh, God! Oh, God! Look at this place!
The robot vacuum, thank God, was back from the shop and working. While it sucked its way over the floors, she'd gone about the house in its wake, trying to keep up, grabbing up everything small enough to be conveniently moved, giving a lick and a prayer with the ultrasound duster, then moving on. John Rourke scrubbed at his hair to get out the blonde dye he'd washed in to accompany what he considered his less-than-inspirational performance as a German tourist. He hadn't had the time to wash it out before going off with the SEAL and TAC teams. He smudged off the steam on the crystal of his Rolex. A couple of minutes to dress, then a quick walk down to the motor pool and off.
Oh, fuck! Oh, fuck! Running out of time!
Once the water was on, she scrubbed shampoo through her hair with one hand while she lathered her body with the other, sort of like whistling, jumping up and down on one foot and rubbing her tummy at the same time. She told herself to calm down. Regardless of the time, she refused to look at her wristwatch, at the same time reminding herself to get it off her wrist when she dressed because the timepiece was too clunky and mannish-looking. She stood under the warm water, the conditioner rinsed out of her hair, no other purpose for standing there naked and wet than that it felt good. But her mind was not idle. She was about to entertain a living legend, a 20th century adventurer who was, in a technical manner of speaking, still married, and despite the fact that she tried to ignore it, who outranked her considerably. And he was terrific looking, with just the right sprinkling of gray in his dark brown hair, those gorgeous brown eyes so full of soul and meaning and...
You're losing it, Emma!
If she kept thinking about John Rourke, she'd need another shower. John Rourke, hair combed, stood naked in front of his two black ballistic nylon bags. There'd been no opportunity to organize his lodgings, and at any rate, clothes these days didn't wrinkle, so there wasn't much concern over keeping them in his bags. He took out a gray tweed sport coat, black short-sleeved knit shirt, black slacks, black socks, a pair of underpants, a handkerchief, and one of the two dress belts he owned. The belt, lined, was made for him before the night of the war by Milt Sparks. He'd treated the leather each time before taking the sleep and each time after awakening. A little brasso, he had the Germans reproduce the venerable old product for him, and the brass buckle looked as good as it had the first day he'd gotten it. But now, the buckle polished, he didn't even need the brasso. Emma Shaw, her terry cloth bathrobe cinched at her waist and her hair wrapped in a bath towel, stood, feet planted firmly in pink scuffs, staring into her closet.
Ugh! How can I have nothing to wear?
At her BOQ, she had a couple of civvy dresses, blouses and skirts, some jeans, and whole bunches of uniform-related items. Everything from dress whites with A-line skirts and funny hats to battle dress utilities and flight suits. In this closet, however, reposed the bulk of her wardrobe. There were four bridesmaids' dresses, one pink, one purple, one yellow, and one baby blue, each of which she had worn exactly once, discounting fittings. From there, ritziness went downhill quickly. 20th century women dressed in a style anywhere from Donna Reed's to Madonna, the singers. Emma Shaw's closet contained neither demure-looking full-skirted shirtwaist dresses nor erotic-looking corsets and garter belts. What would a 600-year-old 20th century man of the world...
Oh, God. How many women has he... whatevered with?
Her watch, the one that was waterproof, shockproof, anti-magnetic, and just about everything else she needed for combat, was still on her left wrist. She looked at it now. It was 8 o'clock, and her hair was still wet, and dinner was only started, not done. There was a system she could use if she had to. Close her eyes and reach into the closet and wear whatever she touched. With her luck, it'd be one of the awful-looking bridesmaids' dresses.
Oh, that'd be real damn subtle now, wouldn't it?
John Rourke slipped his feet into a pair of black leather loafers and picked up his double Alessi shoulder rig. He slung it on, the twin stainless Detonics miniguns already secured. Inside the waistband of his trousers, clipped to his belt, was the A.G. Russell Sting 1A Black Chrome. He put on his tweed sport coat, a spare magazine in each side pocket. He got his wallet, his money. The necessity for money again after all these years was an odd experience. The battered old Zippo, his cigars. The entry card key to his quarters was inside his wallet. He grabbed 3 items, which he clipped into the left inside breast pocket of his jacket. The smaller of his mini mag lights, a brass Heckler & Koch ballpoint pen, and a B&D Grande pen-shaped folding knife. On impulse, John Rourke picked up a pack of German cigarettes. They were filterless, to his liking. Tasted as good as any American brand he'd ever tried before the night of the war, and were entirely non-carcinogenic. Plus, they were more acceptable indoors than a cigar. In bra, panties, and slip, Emma Shaw picked up her dress from the bed where she'd laid it. Earrings, bracelet instead of wristwatch, a slender gold chain for around her neck. She had it all planned out as she started pulling the garment on over her head. It was navy blue, a sundress with wide straps, a full skirt, and 2 big patch pockets. Still on the bed was the crocheted shawl she would put across her shoulders if the evening turned chilly. The shawl was the one thing she'd ever crocheted in her life, which had turned out all right. Another advantage to it was that she could casually drop the fact that she herself had made it.
Men love that sort of thing, right?
She reached her hands behind her and started doing the buttons. What if John Rourke came early? Emma shook her head, telling herself that he'd probably be late, unfamiliar with the roads as he was. Just because he was the great survivalist didn't mean he'd be able to find her house that easily. And he'd just be leaving about now anyway.
Oh, you have got to be fucking kidding!
When Emma Shaw opened the door, John Rourke took a step back. It was involuntary. Backlit, she reminded him of Sarah. Her hair, her figure, her height, the set of her shoulders with classic feminine slope, yet lowered, not raised as if in fear or apology. And what would Sarah think? Would she understand that they were just comrades in arms, getting together for a friendly meal and conversation? Of course she would. He had never been unfaithful to his wife, no matter how close he'd come to it with Natalia. And even though Sarah lay comatose and near real death in cryogenic sleep, a bullet lodged inoperably deep within her brain, John Rourke would not be unfaithful to her now.
Hi.
Hi.
Come on in, John.
I was unintentionally rude. I should have brought something like a bottle of wine or...
No. That's all right. Take your coat.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So, have any trouble finding it?
The house? No. I took an FOUO out of the Pearl Motor Pool. The car drove me up here by itself.
Rourke began removing the shoulder rig. There was a small table opposite from the closet where he could set the guns. His little knife wouldn't really matter.
Kind of take the fun out of it, don't they? Driving, I mean. Must have been terrific to really drive. Like flying still can be when you... turn off the right things.
Yeah. Nice house.
Want the nickel tour?
Well, the smallest I've got a 20.
How about a drink?
Yeah, sure.
Why don't you fix, okay? I've got something in the microwave I need to check.
Fine.
This way.
Rourke watched her walking across the room for a beat. She reminded him of Sarah in some physical ways. He shook his head and followed her, past a comfortable-looking couch that seemed more like something from his era than hers, up 3 steps to the kitchen. The counter had several bottles of liquor set on it and some glasses. He picked up a bottle of vodka. The brand name was unrecognizable. He set it down and picked up the bottle of blended whiskey. It was the same story.
Ice?
No.
You don't have any ice?
Oh! No, I mean, I don't use ice. I thought most men didn't like ice in their drinks. I've got ice, though.
Emma went to what Rourke assumed was a refrigerator, opening a large panel which didn't look like a refrigerator door at all and was set between part of the counter spaces. She touched a lighted rectangle within the door, and what seemed like an ice bucket emerged and ice fell into it.
Here you go, John.
What do you drink?
Scotch.
How many fingers?
Fingers? What the hell? I mean, I don't understand. Fingers?
It's it's a primitive measuring system. You want a lot of scotch or a little?
A lot.
Atta girl. Put your own water in it. I could never get it right.
Fine. I like a lot of water anyway.
Rourke took 3 ice cubes. They were perfectly formed and put them in his glass. When he looked up, she was standing on the other side of the counter, holding her glass as if raised for a toast.
To good friends and comrades in arms.
Comrades. Right.
Wilhelm Doring looked magnificently handsome. His short blonde hair was caught up in the wind and the fine mist of spray blowing over the prow of the hired Russian vessel. His chest swelled beneath the black turtleneck, his strong chin jutting defiantly forward, the set of his brow in profile more than human. And she was drawn to him like a moth to the proverbial flame. He was all that was German and strong and pure, a hero of the race. As if he'd read her thoughts, he turned away from the sea and looked at her. By the yellow light of the lamp swaying in rhythm with the swells, attached to a bracket a meter or so away and just above his considerable height, she could just make out his expression. Wilhelm Doring seemed at peace. He smiled at her.
What is it, Marie?
I was getting a little nervous, Willie. Soon we will be moving, and then there will be no time for nervousness.
In 1 hour. So that is very soon. In another 15 minutes, we will have the final briefing, and after that, the equipment checks, then move into the pre-launch sequence.
Can we trust these Russian pirates, do you think, Willie?
We require an insertion platform. The Russians will provide that. Afterward, we will require the Russians no longer. Do not worry about it. You had best prepare yourself, Marie.
Yes, Willie.
He walked away, and Marie stood there, the wind whipping her hair, molding her clothing against her, making her aware of every square centimeter of her body.
Willie.
Mm-hmm. Mm. You're a very good cook, Emma.
And she looked very beautiful in the light of the candles which burned between them on the smallish table. It would have been presumptuous to mention that, so he didn't.
Ah, great stereo system.
Stereo?
Your sound system.
Thanks. More wine?
No, I've never been much of a wine drinker. Your brother's a good man.
Thanks for saving his life. Was the fight on the beach as tough as it looked on the news, John?
I didn't see the news.
Looked like one hell of a fight.
We encountered a more substantially sized force than we'd anticipated.
I made dessert.
I'll try.
Apple pie.
I'll force myself.
One vanilla ice cream on it?
A la mode, sure.
A la mode?
It means of the fashion in French.
Oh. Do you speak a lot of foreign languages?
Pretty good Russian, okay German, good Spanish. I've got a little Icelandic I picked up, and I know sign.
Sign?
Deaf speak. Now, see?
What did you say? I mean, nobody's deaf these days with implants and everything.
I was just illustrating what I meant. Mind if I smoke?
What did you say, John? With your hands, I mean.
Cigarette?
Not just now. What did you say to me with your hands?
I said, you are pretty. But I was just giving you an example of sign. I mean, you are pretty.
John Rourke. You're quite a man.
Emma started to get up. She was standing before he was able to get her chair, but he stood.
What do you mean?
She walked around the table, leaned up, and very quickly kissed him on the cheek.
I'll get your apple pie now.
Doring watched the faces of the semicircle all but surrounding him. The eyes set in those faces, bright, alert, eager, and intelligent, watched him back. The air in the Russian vessel's salon smelled stale and slightly sour, as if food had been left too long and allowed to spoil. From the cuisine they'd experienced since joining the freighter at Fort Reno, that seemed indeed like the logical explanation. The group consisted of 10 men beside himself and only one woman, Marie Dreisling.
Gunther, stand at the door.
Yes, Willie.
Gunther, tall, blonde, muscular, and possessed of a ready smile, drew his pistol from beneath his sweater and went to stand beside the already closed door between the salon and the main companionway. Wilhelm Doring looked at the others. They were so young to risk their lives, but their names would be immortal.
A review before we get started, So, our purpose must be foremost in our minds. While the other units infiltrate Hawaii for open military action against the Americans, our purpose is at once more subtle and more important. Remember, in order for our work to achieve its necessary effect, the nature of our group cannot be discovered.
Willie?
Yes, Reinhardt.
Willie, I was wondering, has the device been tried?
I have been waiting for someone to ask that question since we began training for this mission. And I will assure you the answer is yes. Suitable subjects were fitted with the identical device and death was instantaneous.
These suitable subjects were Icelandic sailors found shipwrecked off the coast of Eden, then flown inland to the training site.
So, there is nothing to worry over in that regard. Any other questions, then?
Doring expected none, and there were none.
Good! Then we rendezvous as arranged for the equipment check. Gunther!
Yes, Willie.
Gunther made his pistol disappear beneath his sweater as he opened the door. Wilhelm Doring looked at his wristwatch. In less than an hour, if these Russian pirates had any suspicions, it would no longer matter. He sat at the far end of the couch, his legs crossed, a cigarette burning between his fingers. Emma Shaw carried his drink in her right hand, her own in her left. She was wearing the shawl now, and she threw out the old line as she handed John Rourke his drink.
I was a little cold.
Living in a home centered around a natural granite cavern like we did, you become used to a little chill in the air.
Emma set her drink on the coffee table, then dropped to her knees beside it, a few feet away from him. She arranged her clothes, drawing the shawl closer around her shoulders.
My mother taught me how to crochet.
My daughter sews and things. A lot. Crocheting's like sewing, I guess.
Oh, I don't sew. I mean, I do buttons and hems and things, but I don't make clothing. I enjoyed making this shawl, though.
It's pretty.
Oh, well, it's pretty basic, really.
You know, I have something to tell you, Emma.
Yes, John?
Well, the old mountain men had all that fringe on their buckskins, and a lot of people thought it was for decoration, but it really wasn't. You know what it was for?
No, John. What was it for?
Well, when something needs repairing, like a ditty bag or a piece of harness, well, they'd just tear off a piece of fringe and use it.
Can't do much harness repair with dazzle yarn. How did a doctor of medicine become a weapons expert in everything?
Now, my dad was in the OSS.
Oh, I know that one. Office of Strategic Services during World War II. Predecessor of the CIA. That's what you were in, right?
Right.
John?
Yeah?
You made the last toast.
John Rourke extinguished his cigarette, raised his glass, and touched it to hers.
Here's to getting to know each other better.
Someone should have yelled hussy at her, but Emma Shaw didn't care. Wilhelm Doring, Marie Dreisling beside him, Reinhard Kleist, Gunther Brock, and the 8 others of the special unit, they were not even given a name, this for security purposes, only a radio call designation, moved aft along the port side of the Vladivostok Queen. When the wind, which blew so strongly over the Russian pirate ship's bow, would momentarily abate, the smells of onions and sausage, unprocessed tobacco, and cheap vodka wafted toward them from below decks. The vessel's captain, who called himself only Dimitri, and a half dozen of his crewmen stood all the way aft of the superstructure. They were near the opening in the rail where the ladder was rigged that led downward toward the small dock. From that dock, the inflatables would be activated and rigged with their silent running outboards. Dimitri and his men were visibly armed, as they always were, and if Dimitri had it in mind to kill his passengers and steal their belongings, weapons, explosives, the inflatables themselves, all useful in his pirate trade, now would be the man's moment. In the last 50 years, then accelerating in the decade just past, piracy on the high seas had flourished. As shipping grew, so did the pirate fleet. As the pressures of potential world warfare mounted, the powers which would have quelled the pirate trade were too involved in their own matters to look to it seriously. The majority of the pirates were, of course, Russian, many of them the descendants of the people of the Soviet underwater city, conquered by the Americans of Midway more than a century ago. But many were disaffected men and some women, these latter known for their brutality, from among the populations of other world groups, including some leathery-skinned descendants of the wild tribes of Europe. Wilhelm Doring stopped a few feet forward of Captain Dimitri.
Greetings, Captain. Soon you will be rid of us.
Yes, but I shall miss having such intriguing passengers as yourselves, and not to mention well-paying. We come to see you off, as I offered. We can always lay off the islands and wait for your return.
As before, Captain, the offer is well-intended, I know, but unnecessary. If we leave the islands, we will be using a different transport.
Doring sensed that there were more of Dimitri's men nearby, and logic dictated it. Dimitri and his men were armed with cutlasses and knives and at least two handguns each, but only two of them carried energy rifles, these slung almost casually. If Dimitri was intent on killing his departing passengers and stealing their belongings, he would have more men ready to step in. The wild tribesman, René, who was Dimitri's first mate, was nowhere to be seen. And René had been eyeing Marie Dreisling ever since they first joined the vessel. Odds were that René and a dozen more of these seaborne brigands were lurking somewhere above in the rigging which shadowed the superstructure, guns charged, knives and cutlasses keen. Doring kept Marie well back from him, behind him and Reinhardt, and he started forward toward the opening of the rail. The butt of the energy pistol carried in the tactical thigh holster on his right leg almost touched Doring's fingertips.
Esteemed passengers, I must say a proper farewell, I am sure.
Dimitri extended his hand to Doring. Doring's right arm arced slowly upward. They clasped hands as if in friendship.
My young friend, I wish you fair seas to the islands and that, whatever your secret mission is about, it goes well and you live to tell of your exploits to your great-grandson.
And I wish to you, Captain Dimitri, all that within your heart you wish to be.
Dimitri, who was left-handed, had probably done this a dozen or 100 times before. Wilhelm Doring, on the other hand, although right-handed by birth, had trained himself to be ambidextrous in all things except writing, which he could manage with his left hand, but did poorly. Doring sensed the body movement, the resetting of the shoulders, the tightening of Dimitri's grip. Doring's left hand grasped the hilt of one of the several knives he carried. He punched the blade forward and upward, coming in below the level of Dimitri's belt and the body armor vest, which the pirate captain habitually wore.
Now!
At the far right edge of Doring's peripheral vision, he could see Reinhardt shoving Marie back and out of immediate danger, then swinging up his energy rifle to fire.
Kill them!
Doring's left hand was already moving his energy rifle into position, his right flexing to recover circulation as he grasped his pistol. There was a blur of motion to his left, some of René's men, he surmised. Then, as Doring stepped back, something struck the energy rifle from his grasp. The weapon swung on its sling and crashed against his left thigh. Doring wheeled left, steel sliced air, and Doring ducked. It was René, the leathery-faced wild tribesman, first mate to Dimitri. In René's right hand was a cutlass, in his left, a pistol.
Shit!
Willy, look out!
Doring had his pistol up to fire. As Doring leveled the weapon, René's cutlass swiped toward him. Doring dodged, but the cutlass caught the pistol less than an inch forward of the trigger guard. It was a backstroke of the cutlass, so instead of breaking Doring's wrist, it tore the gun from Doring's hand. Doring stumbled over a body. Doring's left hand found the pistol grip of his energy rifle, and he stabbed the weapon forward now, blocking René's downwardly hacking cutlass with his own blade as he fired the rifle point blank.